Thank you.
Be seated, please. Good morning. We welcome you to the Idaho Supreme Court, a convening in Fertilane, Idaho, for the final case of our Fertilane term. This matter is Lotville versus Green Enterprises Incorporated. Appellants are here. Green Enterprises, Catherine and Larry Cummings, and James and Julie Frank, represented by John Magnuson. Respondents Matthew Bonnie Lockwell are represented by Daniel McLaughlin. Gentlemen, do either of you have any preliminary matters today before we proceed?
No,
Your
Honor.
No, Your Honor.
Very well, Mr. Magnuson, may argue.
Well, may it please the court and counsel, my name is John Magnuson. I represent the appellants. It's nice to see you in person and not on the TV screen. I'm a little bit more adept without the TV screen, although I notice that you are about a football field away as opposed to Boise, and you're kind of tight quarters up there. But it's good to see you. I think the one thing the parties can agree on as I prepared for today and reflected on the record, this case was filed 5 years ago. We had a four-day trial, been darkening your door two times. From the start to the finish, South Camp Bay Road doesn't travel a great distance, but I think we can all say it's a long, long road. So, unlike the previous appeal in this matter, with a hodgepodge of issues, the issue today is very discreet and very distinct. The issue, from our standpoint, is whether the district court's second and third supplemental judgments or amended judgments on remand were consistent with the relief requested by the lawfellows and the findings of this court's prior decision, the substitute decision. The lawfellows' complaint in this matter, and there were many of them, but they were all consistent in this regard. They all sought a declaration of a prescriptive easement for residential construction and for residential use. In fact, the last complaint filed shortly before trial included both requests, which is why the district court, in entering the original judgment since vacated, allowed the lawfellows, awarded the lawfellows, a prescriptive easement for residential purposes, which would include residential construction and residential use. As this court knows, I won't belabor it because I noted in the court's substitute opinion that somebody taking the research to say, I think it was 34 times, the phrase reasonably clear and convincing evidence had been used. So I know that more cases than we can count, at least 34 and probably more. But the elements of the prescriptive easement in this context require that the use sought by prescription cannot impose an unreasonable burden on the serving estate, and it must be reasonably foreseeable. So when we turn to the issue of residential use in this particular case, I harken back to the court's opinion, which found, and I quote, appellants argue that the road development and residential use of Sulphide South are unreasonable expansions of the prescriptive easement. We agree, end quote. Quote, further found, quote, no residential mining or other purpose has been established for Sulphide South, end quote. And finally, there's no support in the record for the view that a residence built in 2015, when Lotwell purchased this property, would have been reasonably foreseeable to the serving estates between 46 and 54. Now, I recognize in light of these findings, the court's specific holding was that, quote, using South Camp Bay Road to construct a residence on Sulphide South is beyond the scope of the prescriptive easement, quote. But the matter is remanded. We had a party who requested a right for residential use and residential construction, and I think that, in fairness, the law has recognized the scope of this court's decision. Ultimately, this court's the only one going to tell us what it meant. But the Lotwells petitioned the court for rehearing. And the Lotwells asked the court, quote, this court, reconsider its finding and decide that the construction of the road system over Sulphide North using South Camp Bay Road and the proposed use of South Camp Bay Road to access the lot of property for residential purposes is not an impermissible expansion of the prescriptive easement, quote. The lot was also suggested that this court erred when it found that residential use of Sulphide South was not reasonably foreseeable. So clearly, Wattles understood what I suggest is the import of the court's decision, that although the holding was confined to residential construction, it did not denigrate nor take away from the findings that residential use was not within the scope of the prescriptive easement. So on the end, the judgment is proposed by both parties, and recognize, as I said at the outset, we aren't the architects of the residential use. This was in the original judgment. It was in the complaint, and the judge followed literally the holding, which we suggest is an error because there were two claims for relief in that regard, and only one was addressed. And to that, the respondents say the appellant should have petitioned the court for rehearing. To that, I say, rehear what, with all due respect? Rehear the issue of whether or not it is not reasonably foreseeable that Sulphide South would be used for residential use. The court had already pronounced that. I feel like the petition for rehearing and say, did you really mean what you said? I mean, I read it, and I think it still stands for what it says. It also said that it wasn't reasonably foreseeable and that it was an unreasonable expansion, but the unreasonable expansion or the unforeseeability suggests that the request for relief in the form of prescriptive easement allowing residential use is improper and should have been addressed in the judgment. It's suggested, again, by the Wattles that missing this appeal is frivolous. And I say to that, well, one, as I already indicated, why would we petition for rehearing against that background? Two, why would the district court over objection fail to address one of the claims asserted by the Wattles? And three, if there's some, you know, imagine what happens if I don't appeal. If I don't appeal, and let's say the Wattles build a house on the property through means other than South Canterbury Road, be they boat-in materials, or be they helicopter, or be they come down Green Bay Road. They build the house, and then they seek to access the house for use, be it one house, two house, be it their own house, be it a vacation rental, they come down South Canterbury Road. And then the parties who I represent say, cry foul, and say, you can't use this for residential purposes. And they'll say, well, that issue's already been addressed and subsumed in the case of Lafayette Levy Green Enterprises number one, and you didn't take an appeal, and you're stuck with that. And so it would be arguably malpractice if we didn't appeal against the procedural and factual background of this case. So, you know, for those reasons, we would suggest and request that the court vacate the second and third amended judgments on remand, remand the matter with instructions to issue a fourth amended judgment that addresses the claim for residential use and consistent with this court's findings, because that's not going to change. It's still not foreseeable, and it's still an unreasonable expansion. Those are findings, and the claim needs to be addressed, and it will promote judicial efficiency going forward. It's not saying we're going to preempt another lawsuit. One can never say what happens in the future, but it's a claim in this lawsuit, and it needs to be addressed if it wasn't.
Counsel, I guess my struggle with your argument is I take you to be saying if the Lavalas wanted to truck in miners in and out every day and truck in and out ore every day, that would be fine. But if they build a house on the property, let's just say one house, I understand your argument about, you know, building a community of multiple houses, and let's set that aside for a minute because I think that's another different issue. But if they build one house on the property, they can't drive to and from their house every day. And my struggle is, how is that use really any different, whether you're trucking in miners and ore, or you've got one family driving to and from their house? How is the actual physical use of the road any different? And why should we say it's okay to do it for mining purposes, but it's not okay to access your house.
Well, it's a fair question. I have two answers to that. Number one, you got to build a house first. So to get a house, you have to have a building permit. To get a building permit, you have to show to the satisfaction of the building permitting agency that you have legal access. So, you know, if the lot holds, first of all, we don't know that the lot holds can actually build a house. If this court finds consistent with what we urge, that you can't use the easement for residential purposes or because the way you have it, you can't build a house using the road. But the issue of whether or not you can use the road to access it is open. So we don't know that they won't even be able to build a house with the representation that they can't use South Camp Bay Road as their access. So that's the first part. And the second part is I think this was addressed by the court's previous decision, because it's interesting when you look through the decision and the record and what you all read through before, unfortunately didn't have to look through again, I hope, is that I found it interesting in looking at that between 1948 and 1954, it sounds like a veritable beehive of activity out there, like it's half the mining company, and it's 15 tons of ore, which is what is found. That's 15 one-ton pickup loads over a period of 6 years. This isn't a veritable beehive. And if 15 tons over 6 years is the extent of the import, I think one can reasonably conclude that the degree and intensity of the use, certainly they've established a prescriptive right for mining consistent with the level of mining that was undertaken, but I don't think that suggests that they could go in and, you know, somebody discovers the next Hercules mine and sinks a shaft and wants to have 100 people showing up for work every day on the south half of the sulfide load. I don't think that's consistent with what was there before. So I think that would be my answer to your question. First thing, we don't even know they're going to get a house. And second, I think that the degree of the prior use needs to be gauged accordingly. And lastly, that, you know, this court held that found that sulfide south had never been used for anything. So, you know, any use of sulfide south above and beyond the previous uses on sulfide north is an intensification in use, and I believe this court so found. So, I have any other questions? Thank you.
Thank you. Sir?
Thank you, Justices. To Sir Chief Justice, Madam Clerk, I apologize in advance. I have a little bit of a cold, so my voice is a bit affected, but it shouldn't bother me. I just want to address this. Is again, Mr. Manston is correct. This case has been going on and on a long time. This is the second time we're up here. Fortunately, we're here on a somewhat discreet issue. I want to address that in twofold. First of all, the standard of review, I think, is free review for the court in this issue. Another issue here is whether the Second Amendment judgment issued by Judge Buchanan properly reflects this court's holding as set forth in its substantive opinion, and or whether the relief sought by the appellants herein is barred by Rule 38 or the law of the case doctrine, as a final opinion has already been rendered. The Second Amendment, I think what needs to be very clear is that what Judge Buchanan did with the Second Amendment complaint is followed exactly what this court instructed. If you go to the court's holding, and the court uses the words, we hold three times in its original opinion, in this case, in the substitute opinion. The first two talk about, we hold that you can't use South Camp Bay Road, meaning that Lopelos can't use South Camp Bay Road in order to construct the road through the sulfide north. The final holding says you can't use South Camp Bay Road to construct the road over sulfide north or a home on the Lavalle parcel. It's fine. We understand this, folks. We live by it, and we'll live by it. That is what it is. What none of those things said in terms of the court's holding was that they want to use the road to facilitate, enable, or promote residential use of sulfide south, which is exactly what the appellants are arguing was the court made a mistake, an error, by failing to include those words in the Second Amendment judgment. Now, I'll point out that the the rules facilitate, enable, and promote do not even appear in the court's substitute opinion, except the word enable in an entirely different context. So what the appellants are essentially asking this court to do is to change the substitute opinion and to add language into the substitute opinion that isn't in there. It's essentially a collateral attack on this court's already issued substitute opinion. And Rule 38 simply doesn't allow that. It says, Rule 38, a judgment shall become final 21 days after the last of the following events, I mean the Supreme Court's opinion. The only one applicable here is the announcement of a modified opinion without a hearing. That occurred on May 3rd, 2021. So it became final on May 24th, 2021. This appeal isn't filed until September of 2021. You can't get around the fact that that appeal, that decision is final. It's final under Rule 38.
Counsel, why isn't this just asking us, what did you mean? And sure. I struggle with your argument because I don't see it as a collateral attack. Instead of, you wrote this, what did you mean?
Okay. I understand, Justice, and I appreciate that. And I will move on to what I think the court meant.
No, and if you have a response for why you think this is a collateral attack, I'm inviting you to share that, but I'm asking you to respond to that if you want to, because I just see it as, what does this mean? What does this opinion mean? Does it say this or does it say this?
I appreciate that. I think from my perspective, Judge Gunn was very careful. She said during her oral argument in that case and her deliberation on the record, said, I need to be careful about making sure I follow the court's holding. I just saw it as a law clerk, but that's what we're supposed to do. And she pointed out to Mr. Magnuson that he was a law clerk, and that's what he was supposed to do as well. And it's the holding itself that this court, if you try to parse through it, it says we hold three times. Mr. Magnuson has conceded that's the holding, and none of those words or that language is included in that. So the point being, I think that this court, properly understood and held it to the decision in this case on what was coded and what wasn't, to actually what impacts the serving of state. That's what's important here. The entire public policy behind prescriptive easements and restricting them to the uses done during the prescriptive period is because it acts as a detriment to serving the property owner. So the argument is, well, you can't increase that burden over time by doing something else. And none of the cases that we dealt with here, be it Bays or Aztec or any of the other ones, dealt with the situation we have here, which is there is no increase in the burden on the serving of state. If the lawyers can't build the road, can't bring the construction equipment in, and they can't build a home, all they can do is drive back and forth to their property. So what the court has to do in the Gibbons case instructs is that to go back and actually the court's own findings in this case instruct is to go back and say, well, we need to compare that to what was the uses made during the prescriptive period. Now, we know that the court, I just read the opinion again this morning, recognized that Judge Buchanan felt that there was all sorts of use going on. Schneiderson argues that there was only 15 tons of ore taken out. Well, there were hundreds of feet of tunnel driven before you got to that ore. It's not the amount of ore that matters, it's the work it takes to get to it. And there are tunnels driven from very short length, the beginning of the prescriptive period, to 100 and some feet, two different tunnels they were trying to meet. The point being that there were daily and near daily uses of that road, miners coming in, trucks coming in.
Is that in the record? Sorry.
Yes, I think it is. And when I said near daily, I think I might have misstated that slightly. What the court found is that it was in continuous use. And I think this court recognized that in its own opinion and upheld that finding.
Yeah, but continuous doesn't mean near daily.
Okay. Well, and maybe I'm misinterpreting that. I know I've read that this morning in my own words, and I thought maybe that was a bit of an overstatement, and I apologize for that. It was a use that was commensurate with an active mining operation and the drilling of a mine. And that was any use that was being made. I think that's a finding that the district court made that this court upheld that isn't challenged in front of the court. So the question is the law that is driving to and from their property, whether that's to pitch a tent, to have a picnic, to, if they manage to build a cabin on it, can they drive to and from it? And the focus, I think, from this court and the public policy is on the burden on the serving estate. It has to be that comparison. And there's clearly people driving to and from the property during the prescriptive period. There wouldn't be a prescriptive easement if there wasn't.
So how do we deal with this language in the opinion where we said we also diverge from the district court's conclusion that building a residence on Sulphide South was reasonably foreseeable in 1946 to 1954?
Yeah, I think that's
reasonable foreseeability. They have driven all kinds of mine shafts and hauled water out of there. To me, the import of Ole is wasn't reasonably foreseeable there'd be houses or a house built on this property. And that's kind of what it says. So tell me how that does not take care of this question.
Yeah, and I think I can answer that. First of all, the court did find, and I'll notice that the appellants focus on, this court's own decision, as you know, the appellants focus on the intensification of use that could occur as a result of the proposed construction of the permanent road, and that whether or not those plans to transport materials and amend down South Campbell Road for the construction of a road and a home, such a use diverges from how it's been used over time. And I would submit that what we're talking about here in terms of the foreseeability is only in the context of intensifications of use, so increases in use. That's what we're talking about. There's been no other precedent that I've seen that found that a prescriptive easement couldn't be used if there was no impact on the serving estate, whether foreseeable or not. And if you look at the Biddings decision, it talks about foreseeability in the context of increases in use. Every single case that has addressed this has talked about it in the context of increases in use. But what we have here isn't an increase in use compared to the prescriptive period. What we have here is a decrease in use compared to the prescriptive period. And that was a commercial mining operation that was accessing the lot ball of parcel. And the reason it applies to the whole parcel. What we're talking about now is potentially somebody driving to and from their cabin. The property is extremely steep. I can't imagine it would ever support anything more than a small cabin. It's not conducive to such a thing. So what we're talking about, the possible use of simply driving to and from. Now, think about it in the context from the serving estate owners. Because in fact, this court, I think, recognized that it defined, in terms of whether it's an unreasonable burden. And it's in the context of what would the person who owned property during the prescriptive period have objected to the use that is being made now. That's what this court said before. And the issue is, okay, we've got miners driving in and out. The owners of the green property or the other properties have objected if somebody else or had those same people drove out there and pitched a tent or slept in a cabin. Would that have been any different from the serving estate owner's perspective from the uses they were making then? And the answer is no. It's just driving in and out. In the case of the lot holes proposed use, it would simply be driving in and out in a truck rather than with mining equipment or something else. That is a de-intensification of the use.
Counsel, square that comment you just made with the language further in from the same paragraph that the Chief Justice read that says that the structures that existed in 1947 do not support the logical inference that a residence could be built on Sulphide and Grove South roughly 68 years later. Even if some miners occupied a camp for a time, there is no proof that their habitation was continuous throughout the 5-year prescriptive period.
And I think that the concept there, in my opinion, is that what you can't do is use the road to build the house. Because that's really what the court was focused on.
I don't think that's so much talking about building there as it is habitation.
Right. I understand.
Which is what you're proposing now.
I am. There's no question. I mean, that's not the only use my clients may make of the property. But setting that issue aside for a minute, they would like that right to just simply be able to drive in and out. And they can't access the property through Green Bay Road. They're not allowed to do that. There's no road that connects them. But they could bring materials in by boat, and they could build a home in there. And I understand that the foreseeability argument with respect to that, I think if this court has to decide today, if that's what the court decides to do, whether or not it's sound public policy to say that a prescriptive easement can never change in use, even if there's no increase or even a decrease in the burden on the serving estate. If the people couldn't have subjectively, or didn't subjectively think of that use at the time. And I would suggest that isn't sound public policy, and that isn't supported by Gibbons or any of the other cases. Those cases talk about, and I would ask that the court go back and look at the language in there. In every one of those instances, it's in context of increase in use. That's when the foreseeability is tied to it.
And so what I understand you to be arguing then is Gibbons didn't at all talk about foreseeability in terms of the purpose of the use. Gibbons focused on foreseeability in terms of that the use would increase.
Yeah, I think there has to be, my reading of Gibbons is a two-factor test. One, there has to be a burden, an increase in burden, number one, an unreasonable increase in burden. And then number two, you get to the foreseeability. If you don't get an increase in unreasonable burden, you don't need to get to foreseeability because the entire policy behind the restricting prescriptive easements is to prevent injury to the serving estate owner. And if there is no injury, then what are we doing? What is the purpose behind that rule? I mean, we're essentially saying we're going to freeze in time the productivity of properties that are benefited by prescriptive easement, even if there's no injury to the serving estate owner. That is in public policy, I think. If there is a reason for it, I understand, and the other property owner's rights could be a reason for that, but if you look back at the prescriptive period and say, well, these people are doing nothing, or actually less than what they were doing in the prescriptive period, then the foreseeability aspect shouldn't be a prohibition on a public policy ground. And I would suggest that's not even overturning Gibbons or anything else. That's what I think Gibbons says.
So do we need to send this back to the district court then to make findings on the intensity of the use and whether it would increase or has increased?
Your Honor, I think the appropriate way to do it is that the court would rule based upon that, I think just upholding the decision as it stands would make most sense. If there is use that is inconsistent with the court's decision as it stands, and that's a matter for another day. There hasn't been yet, and there's no evidence that there's been any such increased use. I mean, that as of right now, the property is what it is. My clients have a right to go across South by North, no question. What they don't have a right to do is in South Camp Bay Road to impose an additional burden on the serving estate owners by bringing all those construction materials in and out. So I think the record is clear as it stands. I don't think it needs to go back down because there's nothing that's... I mean, the record is what it is.
Well, in fact, the district court actually held in its original decision that the residential use was reasonably foreseeable, right?
Right. That is true, yes.
And you just said no.
What's that?
I said, in our opinion, said no.
Right. And my argument is, and I'm going to ask the court to go back and look at that opinion, and notice that it isn't just simply the foreseeability, it isn't the death knell of the potential change of use. If there's a change of use, that it creates no additional burden at all on those people. And in fact, there's simply somebody driving in and out of property, which is exactly what they were doing. They might have a different subjective intent. They were going out there to drill a mine rather than go out there to sleep in a cabin. But how does that affect the serving estate owner? I mean, the Gibbons case is a good example. They originally there were these farm and some property owners. But they increased that to a whole bunch of different property owners. It was the intensification of the use, the change in the aspect of that use. Same with Aztec, it was a 50-fold increase in the amount of use. They went from a couple families in there to a 200-unit complex. Those are the context that this court has considered it in. That court hasn't considered it in a context where, if you look at the uses in the prescriptive period, the uses that could happen now are far less. If, for instance, the court holds its decision now and my clients were to, build a commercial factory out there or something, then the serving estate owners would have the right to come back to the district court and get that shut down with injunctive relief. That, I think, is the appropriate.
What if they built something that changed the use but didn't change the burden, such as a radio station?
Excuse me. I think in that instance, I think it would still need to be analyzed in the same manner. Number one, is there an unreasonable increase in the burden? I think, like I said, the entire public policy behind this is to protect serving estate owners. If, they helicopter in a TV antenna, satellite antenna, whatever it happens to be, which they don't have any plans to do, but if they did that, and then somebody simply drove back and forth, the same as what occurred during the prescriptive period, if only for a different subjective intent, then I would suggest that it's not public, sound public policy to rule that that is prohibited. You have to first have the burden. And only if there's an intensification or change in use that actually impacts the serving state owner do you look to the foreseeability. Because if it was foreseeable, the argument is, well, you bought the property, you could foresee this coming on, it's a change, the increase. But if it's not increased at all, from my perspective, it shouldn't be objectionable. If it's simply the same person, you know, that would be driving, the owner of that land, driving back and forth.
Do we only look at the burden on the easement itself, or do we look at the collateral effects of the property of the serving estate as a whole? So, for example, it might be less desirable to have a radio tower next to the property than a residence, even if the use, the amount of use is the same. I mean, there are some types of uses that might be more or less desirable for whatever reason. And that doesn't necessarily increase the burden on the road, on the easement, but it could affect things like the property value of the serving estate.
I think that's I didn't even consider that as a possibility, but that's certainly something that could be argued. I mean, we could make the argument that it is an unreasonable burden, not necessarily just because of the road itself, but because of the uses. I mean, if you have an amusement park on it or something that would create a disturbance to the serving estate owners, I think that's a viable argument, absolutely. But I think in this case, there is no evidence at all that there would be, as long as they're not building that road, and those are issues that can be dealt with later. I think the court properly restricted it to the two instances to which the unreasonable burden would, this court found, would be made, if those were made. I don't think this court has to, you know, decide every single potential. And I would assert, you know, respectfully, including words such as what Mr. Madison argues in terms of the types of restrictions that he would suggest are in there, whether enables, facilitates, enables, or promotes residential use. I mean, frankly, what does that mean? I mean, what activities would be prohibited, what wouldn't be? If there was anything that's going to be dreamt in or more litigation here, it would be including words like that. I mean, the words residential can be meaning in a lot of different contexts. I would suggest that it makes the most sense to focus on, first of all, the serving estate owner. What impacts are they going to make? I think this court can quiet title, and already has, any lot ball parcel to an easement across that piece. You can't do the two things that the court said, but beyond that, whether or not you call it residential or not, that's a matter for another day. I think, you know, simply because you call something residential, if somebody has a mining operation out there but puts up a sleeping cabin next to it, is that residential? Are they not allowed to do that? I think clearly they would. I mean, if it's part of the mining operation, there's no prohibition of sleeping on property, I wouldn't think. So, you know, that line, I think, needs to be drawn somewhere else. I think this court, if you just say no residential, at all, that you can't draw over it, that leaves my clients with very little guidance as to what they can kind of do.
I'm going to ask a dangerous question here. I'm just curious what role the logic and common sense have in this. If we say you can't build a house somewhere, but it's okay to live in a house there that doesn't exist now, would that kind of standard make any sense at all?
Right. I don't think this court needs to say that. I think the court can say simply the easement that the only proposed uses right now of the road, and we're not talking about a lot of those property, because the landowners can do whatever they're legally allowed to do on the road. The only issue is whether they can drive over the opponent's property and get to it for those purposes. This court isn't faced with the question of prohibiting the landowners from building a home or not. That's not the issue before the court. The issue before the court is whether or not they can access that help.
So if they have a boat or a helicopter, there's no problem here with whatever they want to do with their property.
Yeah, because that simply wasn't an issue in the case. I mean, if the district court didn't have the ability to say you can't build on your property, and that's just not been an issue, I don't know of any legal authority that would even allow that. What we're talking about here is what can be done on the appellant's properties, the three properties. And I would suggest, and that should be the focus, and what burden is it on them if the Arapahoes by completely other means, have a cabin on there or something else, a yurt, I don't know. And they simply drive over there, have dinner, sleep there, and drive home. I mean, how is that any different than the miners driving there over the property, drilling, maybe they don't get any more that day, you know, and they drive home. I think that's the appropriate test. I think in terms of this folks' decision and how to frame the easement, I think it's already framed how it should be. We're not challenging the court's decision as to not imposing those additional burdens. That's there. I think the court's decision as to how, how it's worded is appropriate. Now, I'll point out, you know, the court, I'm going to read this just because it's from a Wapo decision, the original one. And this court said, when examining whether a planned use of a restrictive easement would impose an unreasonable increased burden, the focus of the inquiry should be on whether it is reasonable to conclude that the owner of the land where the easement is located would have objected to the increased use had it occurred during the restrictive period. And I mentioned this earlier, and I want to bring it up again, because I think the proper focus isn't on what the Wapowas subjectively understand they're doing on their property when they're driving across or going to do on their property. It's what happens to the serving estate. Do they have a basis to challenge that use? Otherwise, you know, I would suggest if there's no impact on the serving estate owners, then public policy favors free use of land. I know this sort of said many times in the context of covenants, restricted covenants on land, that they would be construed narrowly because public policy favors free use of land. But that same concept should apply when you're talking about as long as the prescriptive easement isn't being used in a way that damages the city and the state owner. And if it does, if it is ultimately, then that can be addressed. But I think this court, because there are two proposed uses in the construction of the home through South Campe Road and the building of the road itself, those are the two proposed uses that the district court said weren't unreasonable uses, but this court said they were. I mean, it isn't appropriate, I would suggest, for this court to say try to list every single potential use that wouldn't be appropriate. I think it just isn't, that's not an issue before the court today. I also want to address briefly the argument that Sulfide South is not used for anything. Mr. Meinerson mentioned in his argument, and it was an argument he made in the lower court, which this court picked up on and said in the original decision. The fact is, the Sulfide property was a single parcel of property from 1909, when it was a patented mining claim approved by the U.S. government, until 1986, when it was split into two. The prescriptive easement vested all the way back in the 40s and 50s. Now, when you have an easement that benefits an entire parcel, the splitting of the parcel has no effect on that easement. It doesn't denigrate the easement. You don't go back and then look at the easement and say, well, did you use the back part of the property in that easement or not? The easement goes with the land. That's fundamental real property law. That's the whole point of it. When it burdens the property owner, the same. To say that the Sulfide South was never used for anything ignores the fact that parcel of property benefits from the same easement, the same mining, the same rights as the prescriptive rights that were acquired under the North. So I would suggest that just isn't true. I already mentioned Greenway Road. I only mentioned it again because Mr. Madison brought it up, but that is not the road to which my client's parcels have access. Or Mr. Gill's, which is the other half of Sulfide. It's a road that's located a quarter mile away. It didn't exist. We put in maps from the trial court level showing that it didn't exist until the 80s, at least existed in that area. And this Forest Service owns the land between. There's no permit. There's simply no right. This is the road that my clients have to fit to their property. And they ask simply that they be allowed to enjoy their property, and if they're not damaging or burdening the serving stakeholders in any way, I think that's appropriate. And I think this court recognized that in its first decision. That's all I have unless the justices have any questions.
No, sir.
Thank you.
Madam Clerk, how much time does the appellant have remaining?
18 minutes.
Thank you, Justices. I don't intend to be the horse for 18 minutes, but I have a couple of points I'd like to make. Council posits, what does residential mean? I harken back to my clients aren't the architects of the residential use. We defended a complaint that sought a prescriptive easement for residential use. The district court's original judgment, which you vacated, said residential purposes. Maybe used for residential purposes. As to the issue of law of the case, the law of this case is, I respectfully submit, that residential use is unforeseeable on so by itself, and residential use is an unreasonable expansion. And I think it's disingenuous, with all due respect, to argue otherwise. Otherwise, why does a petition for rehearing made to change those two specific findings? And it wasn't done. So we are dealing with residential use, and that is the question of the day now. The question of whether or not it's intensification, I think that's why the argument, which the court noted when I said, sulfur itself has never been used for anything, and the court cited that favorably, because whatever uses were put on sulfur north, any use on sulfur south is, whether it's residential or not, is de facto an intensification use, because it's never been used for anything. But we don't need to even get to that aspect, because we still have to deal with the issue of foreseeability. And it's clear that the court held that residential use was not foreseeable.
So, counsel, how do we square that with the language of Gibbons that doesn't talk about whether the purpose the property was going to be used for was foreseeable, but whether the increase in use was reasonably foreseeable?
Well, I'd say two things. One, harking back to Sulfide South, has never been used for anything. That really isn't in dispute, that's a finding. So if you're going to use residential use on Sulfide South in addition to your mining use on Sulfide North, then you have created an intensification that was not reasonably foreseeable. And I'd say secondly, that what the council is really asking you to do is once again rehear the finding previously made in the substitute opinion that residential use was not reasonably foreseeable. I mean, the court's already held that. So we accepted that, and so your question is this intensification, is if the residential use is on Sulfide South and it's not intensified in terms of use, is that trump the foreseeability element? That's kind of how I understood your question.
No, my question was, when Gibbons talks about foreseeability, it's not talking about the reason you're using it, it's talking about the intensification of the use. And so I struggle with, and honestly I'll back up a little bit, because I used to do easement work and we always ask the court to say for ingress and egress. So I struggle with how we've moved from you have an easement for ingress and egress to you have an easement for a residential purpose, you have an easement for this purpose. But, you know, stepping back from that, when I read Gibbons, it talks about was the intensification foreseeable, not was the change in purpose foreseeable. So help me understand how residential use matters at all. Isn't the focus under Gibbons, are they using it more than they used to at the time they acquired the easement?
Well, I certainly think that there's cogent evidence in the record to support that use of Sulfide South, which has never been used for anything, for residential purposes would constitute a de facto intensification of use. And I think the court, ultimately the court's going to tell us what the court had. So I haven't said the court had this all day long, but a lot of people who wrote it say it, that really doesn't carry a lot of weight. But whatever it is. I mean, for example, with the case like this, we'd sit through hypotheticals all day, and then it gets more interesting. But I mean, what if they go put, since Sulphide South hadn't been used for anything, what if they go put another mine on Sulphide South and now use it twice as intensive as whatever use was done between 48 and 54? Is the fact that you've got a purpose for use for mining as defined by the scope at the time now give you carte blanche to do whatever you want so long as it fell within that scope? I mean, that's not the issue today, but it dovetails into the residential use and what's an intensification. So now we have two uses on there. And it is an interesting question, and ultimately you're going to answer it for us. But I think that harking back to this residential use, and you said ingress and egress, the difference here is, and we talked about, council talks about public policy, and I never thought of a lot of 35 years ago, my whole time flies, I never thought it would be revisited 35 years later, that while you were a law clerk, you know what we hold means. And I do know what we hold means. I also know what we find means. But I find it interesting that many times over the course of that, with public policy, and don't want to be glib, but I'm kind of that way, but I mean, the old lawyer once said, as I saw the names in the hall, and Nick LaManna, and Scott Reed, and Gene Miller, public policy. If you have the facts, argue the facts. If you have the law, argue the law. If you don't have the facts and the law, argue public policy. And public policy, I know, in terms of prescriptive easements, it is corollary set. Now, I know there's a lot of prescriptive easements, and we recognize them, but you know, that's a penalty. We still acknowledge the right of private property ownership, and you don't want to penalize somebody. So we're going to say, rather than ingress and egress in that context, if you want a prescriptive easement, your prescriptive easement is going to be defined by what you did in the prescriptive period, and that even though a penalty will be allowed because somebody slept on the runs. And so, you know, that's still a little different here in the sense that it's not just ingress and egress, but we have to say, okay, you did this for 6 years, 48, 54, what is it exactly you did? And why are we going to allow that? And we have to define it in some manner. So it, by necessity, because of the facts of this case and the claims at issue in Idaho law and prescriptive easements, you have to get a little messier than normal ingress and egress. So unless Claire has other questions, I hope we don't see you for Lockhart of the Green Enterprises 3. We have four of you were here before, so thank you.
Very well. Thank you, sir. That's it. We appreciate your argument. Your work on the briefing. Thank you so much. Now there's under advisement. We're under decision. And I'll be in recess until November. Oh, no. We have a hearing later this month. Lest I forget. All right. Thank you.
All right.